Moralia, duicidet osirid. All good things, Cle, must be asked of the gods by people of sense, but above all we should pray to obtain from the gods themselves, as far as is attainable for human beings, knowledge of them. For there is nothing greater that a person can receive, nor anything more solemn that he can grant to a god, than truth. God gives men everything else that they need, but of mind and understanding he grants a share, since these are his own possessions and the very things he uses. For the divine is blessed not through silver and gold, nor made strong through thunders and thunderbolts, but through knowledge and understanding. And of all that Homer has said about the gods, this he expressed most beautifully, when he had Zeus declare, "Truly the two of us are of one stock and one lineage, but Zeus was born first and knows more." He thereby represented the sovereignty of Zeus as the more venerable one, being older in knowledge and wisdom. I think, too, that the eternal life which God has been allotted is a happy one precisely, because it never falls behind events in its knowledge of them. And if the knowing and understanding of what exists were taken away, immortality would not be life but mere duration. That is why the longing for divinity is a longing for the truth, above all the truth about the gods, a study and a search that is a kind of recovery of sacred things, more sacred a task than any purity of life or temple service, and one especially pleasing to this goddess whom you serve, who is preeminently wise and philosophical, as indeed her name seems to indicate. For knowledge and understanding belong to her more than to anyone. Isis is a Greek name, as is Typhon, who is an enemy to the goddess, being through ignorance and deception puffed up with delusion, and who tears apart and scatters the sacred discourse, which the goddess in turn gathers and puts together and hands down to those being initiated into deification, through a life of continual self-control, through abstinence from many foods and from sexual pleasure, curbing licentiousness and love of pleasure, and habituating people to endure austere and rigorous service in the temples, the goal of which is the knowledge of the first and the sovereign and the intelligible, whom the goddess bids us seek, since he is with her and beside her. And the very name of her temple both clearly and plainly promises knowledge and understanding of that which is. For it is called the Icyon, as though it were a place of knowing that which is, if we enter the sanctuaries of the goddess in a reasonable and pious manner. Furthermore, many have recorded her as the daughter of Hermes, and many as the daughter of Prometheus, the latter of whom they consider the discoverer of wisdom and forethought, and Hermes the discoverer of grammar and music. That is why, among the muses at Hermopolis, they call the first one Isis, and also Justice, since she is wise, as has been said, and reveals divine things to those who are truly and rightly called bearers of the sacred and wearers of the sacred robe. These are the ones who carry the sacred discourse about the gods, purified of all superstition and needless curiosity, in their soul as though in a chest, and who cloak it, showing forth partly what is dark and shadowy and partly what is plain and bright about their conception of the gods, such as they also display concerning the sacred vestment. That is why it is a symbol that the dead who have been initiates of Isis are adorned with these garments, that this discourse is with them, and that having this and nothing else they go on their way there. For it is not the wearing of beards, Cle, or the carrying of the philosopher's cloak that makes philosophers, nor is it linen garments and shaven heads that make initiates of Isis. Rather, one who is truly an initiate of Isis is the person who, when he has lawfully received what is displayed and enacted concerning these gods, seeks by reason and philosophizes about the truth contained in them. Most people indeed fail to notice even this, the most common and smallest point, the reason why the priests remove their hair and wear linen garments. Some do not concern themselves at all with knowing about these matters. Others say that the priests abstain from wool, as they abstain from meat, out of reverence for the sheep, and that they shave their heads because of mourning, and wear linen because of the color which flax, when in bloom, gives off, resembling the ethereal, bright blue color that surrounds the world. But the true reason for all of this is a single one. For it is not lawful, says Plato, for the impure to touch the pure, and no excess or residue of nourishment is holy or pure, and it is out of excess matter that wool, hair, fleece, and nails grow and sprout. It would therefore be absurd that, while shaving off their own hair during their purifications and making their whole body smooth, they should nevertheless wrap themselves in and wear the hair of animals. Indeed, we ought to think that Hesiod too, when he says, "Do not cut the dry from the green with bright iron at the joyous feast of the gods, from the five-branched thing," is teaching that one must become pure of such things before celebrating a festival, not that one should employ purification and the removal of superfluities during the rites themselves. As for flax, it grows out of the immortal earth and yields an edible fruit, and it provides a simple and pure garment that does not weigh heavily on the one who wears it for covering, one well suited to every season and, they say, least likely to breed lice. Though that is a separate discussion. The priests are so averse to the nature of excess matter that they not only avoid most legumes and the meats of sheep and pigs, which produce a great deal of residue, but even remove salt from their food during their purifications, for several reasons, among them that salt makes them thirstier and hungrier by sharpening the appetite. As for the notion, which Aristagoras mentioned, that salt is considered impure because many small creatures die trapped inside it as it solidifies, that is a foolish idea. It is also said that they water the Apis bull from a well of his own, keeping him altogether away from the Nile, not because they consider the water polluted on account of the crocodile, as some suppose, for nothing is so highly valued by the Egyptians as the Nile, but because drinking Nile water seems to be fattening and especially to produce excess flesh. And they do not want the Apis to be in that condition, nor do they wish it for themselves, but rather that their bodies should sit lightly and easily upon their souls, and not weigh down and oppress the divine element with a mortal burden that is too strong and heavy. As for wine, those who serve the god at Heliopolis do not bring it into the temple at all, on the ground that it is not fitting to drink during the day while the lord and king looks on. The others use it, but sparingly. And they have many wineless periods of purification, during which they spend their time in philosophizing, and in learning and teaching sacred matters. And the kings, being themselves priests, used to drink only a measured amount, as prescribed in the sacred writings, according to Hecateus. They began to drink wine only from the time of Sametichus, whereas before that they neither drank wine nor poured it in libation as something friendly to the gods, but rather as the blood of those who had once made war upon the gods, from whose fallen bodies, mingled with the earth, they believed the vines sprang up. Which is why becoming drunk makes people frenzied and deranged, since they are, as it were, filling themselves with the blood of their ancestors. This, at any rate, is what Eudoxus, in the second book of his voyage, says was told by the priests. As for sea fish, not all the priests abstain from all of them, but from some. The people of Oxyrhynchus, for instance, abstain from fish caught by hook, since, out of reverence for the Oxyrhynchus fish, they fear that the hook might not be pure if an Oxyrhynchus has ever come into contact with it. The people of Sine abstain from the phagrus fish, since it appears to show itself alongside the rising Nile, and being seen, seems of its own accord to announce gladly the coming flood. The priests abstain from all fish, and on the ninth day of the first month, when every other Egyptian eats a broiled fish before his outer door, the priests do not taste it but burn their fish before their doors, having two accounts for this practice, one sacred and elaborate, which I will take up again later, in harmony with what is piously philosophized concerning Osiris and Typhon, the other plain and ready at hand, showing that fish is not a necessary or refined dish, and citing Homer as a witness, since he represents neither the luxurious Phaeacians nor the islanders of Ithaca as eating fish, nor even the companions of Odysseus, for all their long voyage upon the sea, until they came to the direst extremity. In general, they consider the sea to have come from fire and to be set apart from the rest of nature, being neither a part nor an element but a foreign, corrupted, and diseased residue. For nothing is irrational or mythical, nor was anything, as some suppose, built into the sacred rites out of mere superstition. Rather, some things have moral and practical explanations, and others are not without a certain refinement of a historical or a natural kind, as, for example, in the case of the onion. For the story that Dictys, the nurse of Isis, fell into the river and perished while clutching at onions is utterly implausible. But the priests avoid and abhor the onion, taking care to note that it alone thrives and flourishes precisely when the moon is waning. It is unsuitable for those who are either purifying themselves or keeping festival, in the one case because it causes thirst, in the other because it makes those who partake of it weep. Likewise, they consider the pig an unholy animal, since it appears to be mounted for mating chiefly when the moon is waning, and the bodies of those who drink its milk break out in leprosy and scabby roughness. As for the story which they tell when they sacrifice a pig once, at the full moon, and eat it, that Typhon, while pursuing a pig toward the full moon, found the wooden chest in which lay the body of Osiris and scattered it. Not everyone accepts this, regarding it, like many other such tales, as an idle bit of gossip. Rather, they say the ancients meant by this to reject luxury, extravagance, and self-indulgence. So much so that they even claim there stood a pillar in a temple at Thebes inscribed with curses against King Manes, who was the first to release the Egyptians from their poor, unmoneyed, and simple way of life. It is also said that Technactes, the father of Bacchorus, while on campaign against the Arabs, when his baggage train was delayed, gladly made do with whatever food was at hand, and then, having slept a deep sleep upon a pallet, came to embrace frugality. And that from this experience he cursed Manes, and that the priests, approving, inscribed the curse upon the pillar. The kings were appointed from among the priests, or from the warrior class, since the one class had standing and honor through courage, and the other through wisdom. And whoever was appointed from the warriors immediately became one of the priests and shared in their philosophy, which for the most part is concealed in myths and in accounts that contain dim glimmerings and reflections of the truth, as indeed they themselves suggest when they set up sphinxes, quite fittingly, before their temples, implying that their theology contains a riddling kind of wisdom. And the seated image of Athena at Sais, whom they also identify with Isis, bore the inscription, "I am all that has been, and is, and shall be, and no mortal has yet uncovered my robe." Further, though most people think that Ammon is the proper Egyptian name for Zeus, a name which we, altering it, call Ammon, Manetho of Sebennytus thinks that the word signifies the hidden and concealment. While Hecateus of Abdera says that the Egyptians use this very word among themselves when they call someone to them, since it is a word of summoning. That is why they call the first god, whom they hold to be the same as the universe, by the name Ammon, as being invisible and hidden, when they call upon him and summon him to become visible and manifest to them. Such, then, was the reverence of the Egyptians' wisdom concerning divine matters. And the wisest of the Greeks bear witness to it too, Solon, Thales, Plato, Eudoxus, Pythagoras, and, as some say, even Lycurgus, who came to Egypt and associated with the priests. Eudoxus, they say, was a pupil of Chinuphis of Memphis, Solon of Sanchis of Sais, and Pythagoras of Onuphis of Heliopolis. Pythagoras, above all, it seems, was admired by these men and admired them in turn, and so he imitated their symbolic and mysterious manner, weaving his doctrines into riddles. For most of the so-called Pythagorean precepts fall little short of what is written in the hieroglyphic characters, precepts such as "do not eat while seated on a stool," "do not sit on a bushel measure," "do not plant a palm tree," and "do not stir fire with a knife in the house." I myself think that the men's practice of calling the monad Apollo, the dyad Artemis, the number 7 Athena, and the first cube Poseidon corresponds closely to what is established, enacted, yes, and written in the temples. For they represent the king and Lord Osiris by an eye and a scepter, and some even interpret the name to mean many-eyed, since Os in the Egyptian tongue signifies many and Eri signifies I. And heaven, being ageless because of its eternity, they depict with a heart and a brazier set beneath it. In Thebes there stood dedicated images of judges without hands, and the image of the chief justice had its eyes closed, to signify that justice is incorruptible by gifts and inaccessible to influence. For the warrior class, the scarab beetle was engraved as their seal, for there is no female scarab, they are all male. They deposit their seed into a ball of matter which they shape, providing thereby a place not so much for nourishment as for generation. So then, whenever you hear the myths that the Egyptians tell about the gods, their wanderings, dismemberments, and many such sufferings, you must bear in mind what has already been said, and think that none of these things is spoken of as having actually happened or been done in that way. for they do not properly call the dog Hermes, but they associate the watchful, wakeful, and philosophical quality of the animal, which distinguishes friend from enemy by knowledge and ignorance, as Plato says, with the most rational of the gods. Nor do they suppose that the sun rises as a newborn infant out of a lotus, but rather they depict the sunrise in this way to hint at the kindling of the sun that arises out of moisture. And indeed, when the most savage and terrifying of the Persian kings, Achis, who had killed many, and who at last also slaughtered the Apis and dined upon it with his friends, they called him the knife. And to this day they still so name him in the list of kings, not, of course, signifying his real nature by this, but likening the harshness and wickedness of his character to a murderous instrument. In just this way, then, one who hears about the gods and receives such things from those who interpret the myth in a pious and philosophical manner, and who always performs and preserves the established rites of the temples, while believing that having a true opinion about the gods will please them no less than sacrificing or performing any rite, will thereby escape an evil no less than atheism, namely, superstition. Now this myth is told in the briefest form possible, setting aside what is most useless. Once the superfluous elements have been removed, they say that Rhea had intercourse secretly with Cronus, and that Helios, perceiving it, called down a curse upon her that she should bear no child in any month or year. But that Hermes, being in love with the goddess, lay with her, and afterward, playing at draughts with the moon, won from her the 70th part of each of her lights, and out of all these portions composed 5 days, which he added to the 360. These are the days the Egyptians now call the added days, and they celebrate them as the birthdays of the gods. On the first of these days, Osiris was born, and a voice went forth together with him at his birth, declaring that the Lord of all things was coming into the light. But some say that a certain Pamels, drawing water at Thebes from the shrine of Zeus, heard a voice commanding him to proclaim with a shout that the great king and benefactor Osiris had been born, and that for this reason he reared Osiris, Cronus having entrusted the child to him, and that the festival of the Pamelia, resembling the Phalaphoria, is celebrated in his honor. On the second day Eris was born, whom some call Apollo, and others the elder Horus. On the third, Typhon, not at the proper time nor in the proper place, but bursting through with a blow, he leapt out through his mother's side. On the fourth, Isis was born amid all moisture. And on the fifth, Nephthys, whom some name also Teleute and Aphrodite and others Nike. Osiris and Eris, they say, were sons of Helios, Isis was the daughter of Hermes, and Typhon and Nephthys were children of Cronus. For this reason, the kings, regarding the third of the added days as ill omened, conducted no business on it and did not attend to their own affairs until nightfall. Nephthys was married to Typhon. Isis and Osiris, being in love with each other, had intercourse in the darkness even before they were born, while still in the womb. Some say that Eris too was born in this way, and that he is called the elder Horus by the Egyptians and Apollo by the Greeks. When Osiris became king, he immediately delivered the Egyptians from their destitute and beast-like way of life, by showing them crops, establishing laws for them, and teaching them to honor the gods. Afterward, he traveled over the whole earth, civilizing it, having very little need of weapons, but winning over most people by persuasion and reason, charming them with song and every kind of music. Hence the Greeks came to believe that he was the same as Dionysus. While Osiris was away, Typhon attempted nothing new, because Isis, who held power, guarded herself and watched closely. But when Osiris returned, Typhon contrived a plot, having formed 72 conspirators, and having as an accomplice a queen from Ethiopia who happened to be present, whom they name Aso. Having secretly measured Osiris's body, and having had a chest made, beautiful and elaborately adorned, fitted exactly to that measurement, he brought it into the banqueting hall. When the guests were delighted at the sight and admired it, Typhon promised, as a jest, that whoever, lying down in it, fitted exactly, should be given the chest as a gift. When each of them in turn tried it and none fit, Osiris got in and lay down. The conspirators then rushed up and slammed the lid shut, and some nailing it fast from outside and others pouring molten lead over it, carried it out to the river and released it into the sea through the Tanitic mouth, which for this reason the Egyptians even now call hateful and execrable. This is said to have happened on the 17th day of the month Athar, when the sun passes through Scorpio, in the 28th year of Osiris's reign. Some, however, say that he had lived, not reigned, that length of time. The Pans and Satyrs who lived around the region of Chemes were the first to perceive what had happened and to spread word of it. And for this reason, sudden disturbances and frights among crowds are still called panics to this day. Isis, on learning of it, cut off a lock of her hair there and put on mourning garb in the place that is still to this day called Koptos. Others think the name signifies deprivation, for they say the Egyptians call depriving Kopto. Wandering everywhere in her distress, she passed no one without speaking to them. And when she met with small children, she asked them about the chest. And they, as it happened, had seen it and told her the mouth of the river through which the friends of Typhon had pushed the vessel into the sea. For this reason, the Egyptians believe that children possess a prophetic power, and they especially take omens from the chance utterances of children playing in sacred places and saying whatever they happen to say. Isis learned that Osiris, in ignorance, had had intercourse with her sister Nephthys, taking her for Isis herself, and she saw as proof of it the garland of Melilot which he had left with Nephthys. So she sought for the child, for Nephthys, immediately after giving birth, had exposed it out of fear of Typhon. It was found with difficulty and effort by Isis, who was guided by dogs, and it was reared and became her guardian and attendant, called Anubis, who is said to guard the gods just as dogs guard men. From this she learned about the chest, that it had been carried by the waves to the region of Byblos, and the swell had gently brought it to rest against a tamarisk bush. And the tamarisk, growing in a short time into a most beautiful and enormous shoot, enfolded it, grew around it, and hid it within itself. The king, marveling at the size of the plant, cut off the trunk that enclosed the coffin, invisible within it, and set it up as a support for the roof of his palace. They say that Isis, learning of this by a report carried on some divine inspiration, came to Byblos, and, sitting by a spring, humble and in tears, spoke to no one else, but greeted and befriended the queen's handmaidens, plaiting their hair and breathing upon their skin a wonderful fragrance from herself. When the queen saw her handmaidens, a longing seized her for the stranger, whose hair and skin breathed a fragrance as of ambrosia. So Isis was sent for, and, having become intimate with the queen, was made nurse of her child. The king's name, they say, was Malchandris. The queen's name is given by some as Astarte, by others as Seasses, and by others as Nemenis, which the Greeks would call Athenais. Isis nursed the child, giving it her finger to suck instead of her breast, and at night she would burn away the mortal parts of its body, while she herself, having become a swallow, flew around the pillar and lamented, until the queen, watching closely, cried out when she saw her baby being burned, and thereby deprived it of immortality. Then the goddess, revealing herself, asked for the pillar of the roof, and, removing it with the greatest ease, cut away the tamarisk. Then, having wrapped it in linen and poured perfume over it, she gave it into the hands of the king and queen. And to this day, the people of Byblos still venerate the wood, which lies in the temple of Isis. She then fell upon the coffin and wailed so loudly that the younger of the king's sons died of it, and taking the elder son with her, and placing the coffin in a boat, she put out to sea. When the river Phaedrus sent forth a rather harsh wind toward dawn, she grew angry and dried up its stream. At the first place where she found solitude, being alone by herself, she opened the chest, and laying her face upon his face, embraced it and wept. When the child came up silently from behind and watched her, she, perceiving it, turned around and looked at it terribly in anger. The child could not bear the fright and died. Others say it was not so, but that, as has been said before, he fell into the sea. He receives honors on account of the goddess, for the one whom the Egyptians sing of at their banquets as Maneros is this very child. Some say that the boy was called Palaestinus or Pelusius, and that the city founded by the goddess was named after him. But they relate that the Maneros who is sung of was the first discoverer of music. Others say it is not the name of any person at all, but rather a phrase suited to men who are drinking and feasting, meaning, may such things be fitting. For this, expressed as to Maneros, is what the Egyptians cry out on each such occasion. Just so, indeed, the image of a dead man that is carried around in a small box and displayed to the guests is not, as some suppose, a reminder of the suffering of Osiris, but rather they bring it in as an unwelcome addition to the revelry, urging themselves, now that they are in their cups, to make use of and enjoy what is present, since they will soon be just such as it. When Isis had gone to her son Horus, who was being reared at Buto, and had set the chest aside out of the way, Typhon, hunting by night in the light of the moon, came upon it, and recognizing the body, tore it into 14 pieces and scattered them about. When Isis learned of this, she searched for the pieces, sailing through the marshes in a papyrus boat. For this reason, those who sail in papyrus skiffs are not harmed by crocodiles, which either fear or revere the goddess. For this reason, many tombs of Osiris are said to exist in Egypt, because, whenever she came upon a piece, she performed burial rites for it. But others deny this, and say instead that she made images and gave one to each city, as though giving the body itself, so that Osiris might be honored by more people. And so that, if Typhon should overpower Horus and go searching for the true tomb, he would give up in despair when many tombs were spoken of and shown to him. Of all the parts of Osiris, the only one Isis did not find was the genital member, for it had been thrown into the river at once, and the Lepidotus, the Phagris, and the Oxyrhynchus fish had tasted of it, fish which the Egyptians for this reason especially abstain from eating. Isis, making a likeness of it in its place, consecrated the phallus, and the Egyptians even now hold a festival in its honor. Afterward, Osiris came from Hades to Horus and trained and exercised him for battle, and then asked him what he considered the finest thing. When Horus answered, "To avenge one's father and mother for the wrongs they have suffered," Osiris asked him a second question, what animal he thought most useful to those going out to battle. When Horus said, "A horse," Osiris was surprised and puzzled why he had not said a lion instead. Horus replied that a lion is useful to one who is in need of help, but a horse serves to pursue and destroy an enemy in flight. Hearing this, Osiris was pleased, feeling that Horus was now adequately prepared. It is said that, as many were continually going over to the side of Horus, even Typhon's concubine Thouris came over to him. A serpent that pursued her was cut to pieces by Horus's followers, and even now, for this reason, they throw a rope into their midst and cut it up. The battle, then, lasted many days, and Horus prevailed. But when Isis took Typhon prisoner in bonds, she did not kill him, but loosed him and let him go. Horus did not take this well, but laid hands on his mother and tore the royal crown from her head, and Hermes put a helmet shaped like an ox's head on her instead. When Typhon brought a suit against Horus for illegitimacy, Hermes came to his aid, and Horus was judged by the gods to be legitimate, and Typhon was defeated in two further battles. Isis, having conceived by Osiris after his death, gave birth to Harpocrates, born prematurely and weak in his lower limbs. These, then, are more or less the main points of the myth, with the most ill-omened details removed, such as the account of Horus's dismemberment and Isis's beheading. Now, that if these things are believed and asserted to have truly happened and occurred, concerning that blessed and imperishable nature by which the divine is above all conceived, then, in the words of Aeschylus, one must spit them out and purify one's mouth. There is no need to say this to you, for you yourself are displeased with those who hold such lawless and barbarous opinions about the gods. But that these things do not seem to be entirely thin and empty fabrications of the sort that poets and prose writers, like spiders spinning from themselves out of an unfounded beginning, weave and stretch out, but that they contain certain accounts of events and narratives of sufferings, this you know yourself. Just as the mathematicians say that the rainbow is a reflection of the sun, given its varied colors by the turning back of our vision toward a cloud, so here the myth is a reflection of some account that turns the mind toward other things, as is suggested both by the sacrifices, which display mourning and a gloomy character, and by the arrangement of the temples, which in some parts open out into wings and open, unroofed colonnades exposed to the sky, while in other parts have hidden and dark underground chambers, resembling burial vaults and shrines. Not least significant is the belief concerning the tombs of Osiris, his body being said to lie in many places. For they say the small town called Diachita is named as the one that alone possesses the true tomb, and at Abydos, the most fortunate and powerful of the Egyptians are chiefly buried, competing with each other for the honor of sharing a grave with the body of Osiris, while at Memphis, the Apis bull is reared, being an image of Osiris's soul, in the place where his body also is said to lie. and the name of the city is interpreted by some as Haven of Good Things, and by others, specifically, as Tomb of Osiris. The islet near Phalah is at other times inaccessible and unapproachable by anyone, and not even birds land on it nor fish come near it. But at one appointed time, the priests cross over and offer sacrifices and wreath the tomb, shaded by a plant called methide, which surpasses in size any olive tree. Eudoxus says that, of the many tombs spoken of in Egypt, it is at Busiris that the body actually lies, since this was in fact the birthplace of Osiris. Taphosiris, on the other hand, needs no explanation, for the name itself declares the burial of Osiris. I pass over in silence the cutting of wood, the splitting of linen, and the libations that are poured, because many of the mystic rites are mixed up with these matters. The priests say this not only of Osiris, but also of the other gods, all those who are neither unbegotten nor imperishable, that their bodies, having grown weary, lie among them and receive rites of care, while their souls shine as stars in heaven, the star of Isis being called the dog star by the Greeks, and Sothis by the Egyptians, Orion being the star of Horus, and the bear that of Typhon. And as regards the burial rites for the sacred animals, all other Egyptians perform the prescribed contributions, but the inhabitants of the Thebaid alone do not contribute, since they hold that no god is mortal, but only the one whom they themselves call Neph, who is unbegotten and immortal. Since many such things are said and shown, some, believing that these are the deeds of kings and rulers who, on account of surpassing virtue or power, claimed for themselves the dignity of divine repute, and then met with fortunes such that their terrible and great deeds and sufferings are still remembered, resort to the easiest escape from the difficulty, and not without some skill, transfer the ill-omened elements from the gods to human beings, finding support for this in what is recorded in the histories. For the Egyptians relate that Hermes, with his, in body, that Hermes was bandy-legged, Typhon reddish in complexion, Horus white, and Osiris dark, as though they had been born men by nature. They also call Osiris a general, and Canopus a helmsman, after whom, they say, the star is named. And the ship which the Greeks call the Argo is a starry image, set among the stars in his honor, of Osiris's own vessel, and it moves not far from Orion and the dog star, of which the one the Egyptians hold sacred to Horus, the other to Isis. I am reluctant to disturb what should not be disturbed, and to war, not merely, as Simonides says, with the long march of time, but with many nations of men and races held fast by their piety toward these gods, reducing to nothing and dragging down from heaven to earth names and honors so great, and a faith almost woven into everyone from his very birth, thereby throwing open great gates to a godless rabble and turning the divine into the merely human, and giving free rein to the impostures of Euhemerus of Messene, who himself composed a fictitious record of an incredible and non-existent mythology, and has poured out atheism over the whole inhabited world by leveling all the gods men believe in into names of generals, admirals, and kings who supposedly lived long ago and are recorded in golden letters at Pantia. Letters which no barbarian and no Greek, but only Euhemerus himself, it seems, ever saw. Having sailed to visit the Panchaeans and Triphylians, who exist nowhere on earth and never existed. And yet great deeds are celebrated in song among the Assyrians as belonging to Semiramis, and great ones among the Egyptians as belonging to Sesostris. The Phrygians to this day call brilliant and marvelous achievements Manic, after a certain Manes, a good and powerful king of old among them, whom some call Masts. Cyrus led the Persians and Alexander the Macedonians to conquer very nearly the ends of the earth, yet these have only the name and memory of good kings. But if certain men, puffed up by vainglory, as Plato says, their souls ablaze with youth and folly together with insolence, accepted divine titles and the founding of temples in their honor, their glory flowered only briefly. And then, along with impiety and lawlessness, they incurred a reputation for emptiness and imposture. Short-lived, they were borne up like smoke and vanished, and now, like runaway slaves dragged back in chains, torn away from their shrines and altars, they possess nothing but their monuments and their tombs. Hence Antigonus the Elder, when a certain Hermodotus in his verses proclaimed him son of Helios and a god, said, "My chamberpot bearer knows nothing of the kind about me." and Lysippus the sculptor rightly rebuked Apelles the painter, because in painting a portrait of Alexander, he had put a thunderbolt in his hand, whereas he himself had given him a spear, the glory of which no length of time will ever take away, since it is true and truly his own. Better, then, are those who hold that the things told of Typhon, Osiris, and Isis are the sufferings neither of gods nor of men, but of great demons, beings whom Plato, Pythagoras, Xenocrates, and Chrysippus, following the ancient theologians, say came into being stronger than men and far surpassing us in the power of their nature, yet not possessing the divine element unmixed or pure, but sharing also in the nature of soul and of body, allotted a share in sensation, receiving pleasure and pain. And whatever affections attend these changes disturb some more, some less. For, as among men, so among demons there are differences of virtue and vice. Indeed, the tales of the giants and titans sung among the Greeks, certain lawless deeds of Cronus, the resistance of Python against Apollo, the flights and wanderings of Dionysus, and those of Demeter, fall short in nothing of the Osiriac and Typhonic stories, nor do the other tales which anyone is free to hear recounted without restraint. And whatever is kept hidden under the veil of mystic rites and secret ceremonies, unspoken and unseen to the multitude, admits of a similar account. We hear too that Homer variously calls the good godlike on each occasion, and godlike opposing, and having thoughts from the gods, while he uses the term demon indiscriminately of both the good and the bad. Come near, O demonic one, why do you so fear the Argives? And again, but when for the fourth time he rushed on like a demon, and demonic one, what harm have Priam and the sons of Priam done you, that you rage so relentlessly to sack the well-built citadel of Ilium? As though demons possessed a mixed and uneven nature and moral character. Whence Plato assigns to the Olympian gods the things on the right hand and the odd numbers, and to the demons their opposites. And Xenocrates holds that the inauspicious days, and those festivals which involve blows, beatings of the breast, fasts, curses, or foul language, belong to the honor neither of good gods nor of good demons, but that there exist in the surrounding air natures great and powerful, yet perverse and gloomy, who delight in such things, and obtaining them, turn to nothing worse. The good and virtuous ones, on the other hand, Hesiod calls holy demons and guardians of men, givers of wealth, possessing this kingly privilege too. Plato likewise calls this class of being interpretive and ministering, situated between gods and men, carrying up to the gods the prayers and petitions of men, and bringing back down from them oracles and gifts of good things. Empedocles says that the demons pay a penalty for whatever they sin and transgress. For the might of the Aether pursues them into the sea spits them out onto the floor of the earth casts them into the rays of the unwearied sun, and he in turn flings them into the eddies of the Aether. One receives them from another, and all of these abhor them, until, thus chastened and purified, they at last recover their proper place and rank according to nature. Of these and similar beings, they say kindred things are told concerning Typhon. How out of envy and ill will he wrought terrible deeds, and having thrown everything into confusion, filled almost the whole earth and sea alike with evils, and afterward paid the penalty. And she who avenged Osiris, his sister and wife, having quenched and put an end to Typhon's madness and fury, did not disregard the labors and struggles she had endured, nor her own wanderings. And having consecrated many deeds of wisdom, and many of courage, adopting a policy of forgetfulness and silence, yet weaving into her most sacred rites images, hints, and reenactments of the sufferings then endured, she made them into a lesson of piety and a consolation at once for men and women caught in similar misfortunes. She herself and Osiris, having changed from good demons into gods on account of their virtue, as later did Heracles and Dionysus, hold, not inappropriately, honors that combine those of gods and of demons together, being most powerful everywhere, but especially in the regions above and below the earth. For they say Serapis is none other than Pluto, and Isis is Persephone, as Archimachus of Euboea has said, and Heraclides of Pontus holds that the oracle at Canopus belongs to Pluto. Ptolemy Soter saw in a dream the colossal statue of Pluto at Sinope, without knowing or ever having seen before what its form was like, commanding him to bring it to Alexandria as quickly as possible. Not knowing where it stood, and being at a loss, and while he was describing the vision to his friends, there was found a much-traveled man named Sosibius, who said he had seen at Sinope just such a colossus as the king seemed to have seen. Ptolemy therefore sent Sotals and Dionysius, who after a long time and with much difficulty, yet not without divine providence, brought it away by stealth. When it had been carried off and was seen, Timotheus the expounder of sacred rites and Manetho, the Sebennyte, comparing notes, concluded from the Cerberus and the serpent that it was an image of Pluto, and persuaded Ptolemy that it belonged to no other god but Serapis. For it did not come from their already bearing that name. Rather, once brought to Alexandria, it acquired, under the Egyptian name for Pluto, the title Serapis. And indeed, since Heraclitus the natural philosopher says, Hades and Dionysus are the same, for whom men rave and hold their Lenaean revels, they subscribe to this same opinion. But those who suppose that Hades means the body, in which the soul is as it were deranged and drunk, allegorize too feebly. It is better to identify Osiris with Dionysus, and Serapis with Osiris once he had changed his nature and taken on this new name. That is why Serapis belongs equally to all, just as those who have been initiated into the sacred rites know Osiris to belong to all. For it is not worth paying attention to the Phrygian writings, in which it is said that Isis was born the daughter of Cherops, son of Heracles, and Typhon the son of Aeacus, son of Heracles. Nor should one dismiss Phylarchus's account that Dionysus was the first to bring two oxen from India into Egypt, one of which was named Apis, the other Osiris, and that Serapis is the name of the one who orders the universe, derived from Seren, a word some say means to beautify and adorn. These claims of Phylarchus are absurd enough, but far more absurd are those of the people who say that Serapis is not a god at all, but that this is simply the name given to the coffin of Apis, and that certain bronze gates at Memphis, called the Gates of Forgetfulness and Wailing, are opened whenever they bury an Apis bull, making a heavy, harsh sound, which is why we clap our hands on any resounding piece of bronze whenever we hear it. More moderate are those who say the name derives from Suistai and Saustai, words expressing the motion of the universe as a whole. Most of the priests, however, say that Osiris and Apis are woven together into one, explaining and teaching us that we ought to regard Apis as the embodied image of Osiris's soul. For my part, if the name Serapis is indeed Egyptian, I think it signifies cheerfulness and joy, inferring this from the fact that the Egyptians call the festival of joy Seri. And indeed, Plato says that Hades was named as a gracious and kindly god to those who come to dwell with him. And among the Egyptians, there are explanations for many other names as well, and they call the subterranean place to which they believe souls depart after death, Amenths, the name signifying the one who receives and gives. Whether this, too, is one of the names carried off long ago from Greece and later brought back, we shall examine later. For now, let us go through the rest of the current line of opinion. Osiris and Isis, then, passed from good demons into gods. But Typhon's power, dimmed and worn down, though still gasping and struggling, they at times appease and soothe with sacrifices, and at other times again humble and abuse in certain festivals, insulting men of ruddy complexion and hurling a donkey off a cliff, as the people of Coptus do, because Typhon was reddish and ass-like in color. The people of Busiris and Lycopolis make no use of trumpets at all, because their sound resembles the braying of a donkey. And in general, they consider the donkey not a pure but a demonic animal, on account of its resemblance to Typhon, and in the sacrifices of the months of Paeni and Phaethi, they make cakes stamped with the image of a bound donkey. And in the sacrifice to the sun, they instruct those who worship the god not to wear gold ornaments on their bodies, nor to give food to a donkey. Even the Pythagoreans appear to consider Typhon a demonic power. For they say that, reckoned in the even number, Typhon belongs to the 56th. And again that the triangle belongs to Hades, Dionysus, and Ares, the square to Rhea, Aphrodite, Demeter, Hestia, and Hera, the 12-sided figure to Zeus, and the 56-sided figure to Typhon, as Eudoxus has recorded. The Egyptians, believing Typhon to have been reddish in color, also consecrate red oxen for sacrifice, and conduct so exacting an examination that if the animal has even a single black or white hair, they consider it unfit for the offering. For what is fit for sacrifice ought not to be dear to the gods, but on the contrary must be the sort of thing that has caught up the souls of unholy and unjust men transformed into other bodies. Therefore they curse the victim's head, and having cut it off, used formerly to throw it into the river, though now they sell it to foreigners. The bull that is about to be sacrificed is marked by those of the priests called sealers, whose seal, as Castor records, bears the engraving of a man kneeling with his hands bound behind him and a sword laid at his throat. And they think the donkey shares in the same likeness, they suppose, no less because of its stupidity and violent temper than because of its color. For this reason, too, hating Achus most of all the Persian kings, as accursed and polluted, they nicknamed him the donkey. And he, when he said, "Well, this donkey of yours will feast on the ox," had the Apis bull slaughtered, as Danon has recorded. As for those who say that Typhon fled the battle on a donkey's back for 7 days, and having been saved, fathered sons named Hierosolymus and Judeus, they are plainly dragging Jewish matters into the myth by their own admission. These accounts, then, offer such hints and conjectures. But let us first examine, starting from a different point, the simplest of those who seem to speak somewhat more philosophically. These are the ones who say that, just as the Greeks allegorize Cronus as time, Hera as air, and the birth of Hephaestus as the change of air into fire, so among the Egyptians the Nile is Osiris consorting with Isis, who is the earth, while Typhon is the sea, into which the Nile falls and is scattered and disappears, except for the portion which the earth, taking up and receiving, is made fertile by. And there is a sacred lament sung over Osiris, and it laments him as born in the left-hand regions and as perishing in the right-hand regions. For the Egyptians think that the eastern parts of the world form its face, the northern parts its right side, and the southern parts its left side. The Nile, then, flowing from the southern regions and being consumed by the sea in the northern regions, is reasonably said to have its birth in the left-hand parts and its destruction in the right-hand parts. For this reason, the priests hold the sea in religious aversion and call salt the foam of Typhon, and among the things forbidden to them is the setting out of salt at table. Nor do they address pilots with honor, because they make their living from the sea and depend on it for their livelihood, and it is not least for this same reason that they also reject the fish, and they write hate with a fish. At any rate, in size, in the forecourt of the temple of Athena, there was carved an infant, then an old man, and after him a hawk, then next a fish, and last of all a hippopotamus. This symbolically signified, "O you who are coming into being and passing out of being, God hates shamelessness. For the infant is a symbol of coming to be, and the old man of passing away." By the hawk they indicate the god, by the fish, as has been said, hatred on account of the sea, by the hippopotamus, shamelessness, for it is said that after killing his father he forces himself on his mother. The saying of the Pythagoreans, that the sea is a tear of Cronus, would also seem to hint at the impurity of the sea and its being of alien kindred. Let this much, then, be said from outside sources, containing the common tradition. But the wiser of the priests call not only the Nile Osiris and the sea Typhon, but they simply regard Osiris as the whole moisture-producing principle and power, taking it to be the cause of generation and the substance of seed, and Typhon as everything parched and fiery and utterly desiccating and hostile to moisture. Hence, believing that he was born ruddy in body and sallow of complexion, they are not at all eager to meet nor pleased to associate with men of such an appearance. Osiris, on the other hand, they tell in myth was born black-skinned, because water blackens everything it mixes with earth and clothing and clouds, and the moisture present in young people gives their hair its black color, whereas graying, a kind of pallor, comes upon those past their prime through dryness. And spring is luxuriant and fruitful and mild, while autumn, through lack of moisture, is hostile to plants and unhealthy for animals. The bull kept at Heliopolis, which they call Nevis and hold sacred to Osiris, some think it the father of Apis as well, is black and holds second honors after Apis. And since Egypt, being among the most black-earthed of lands, just as the black part of the eye they call Chemia, and they liken it to a heart, for it is warm and moist, and in relation to the southern parts of the inhabited world, is enclosed and situated much as the heart is on the left side of a man. They say that the sun and moon do not use chariots, but sail about in boats as their vehicles, hinting at their nourishment and generation from moisture. They also think that Homer, like Thales, learned from the Egyptians to set down water as the origin and generation of all things. For ocean, they say, is Osiris, and Tethys is Isis, since she nurses and rears all things jointly with him. And indeed the Greeks call the emission of seed apousia, absence and intercourse synousia, togetherness, and they derive the word for sun, huios, from hudor water and from husai to rain, and they call Dionysus Hyes, as lord of the moist nature, he being none other than Osiris. Indeed Hellanicus too seems to have heard the god called Osiris, not Hysiris, by the priests, for he consistently names the god this way reasonably from his nature and from the discovery. That he is the same as Dionysus, who could know better than you, Cle, since it is fitting that you should, you being head of the Thyades at Delphi, and consecrated to the Osirian rites by your father and mother. And if for the sake of others one ought to produce testimony, let the secret rites remain in their place, but consider what the priests openly do when they bury Apis. As they convey the body on a raft, it falls nothing short of Bacchic revelry. For they fasten on fawnskins and carry thyrsus wands, and use cries and movements just like those possessed in the orgiastic rites of Dionysus. That is why many of the Greeks make images of Dionysus in the form of a bull, and the women of Elis actually invoke him in prayer, calling on him to come to them with the foot of a bull. And among the Argives, Dionysus bears the epithet Bullborn. They call him up out of the water with trumpets, casting a lamb into the abyss for the keeper of the gate, while they hide the trumpets inside thyrsus wands, as Socrates has said in his work on holy things. And the Titanic and Nyctalian rites agree with what is said of the dismemberment of Osiris, his returns to life, and his rebirths, and likewise with what concerns his burials. For the Egyptians point out tombs of Osiris in many places, as has been said, and the Delphians believe that the remains of Dionysus are deposited among them beside the oracle. And the holy ones offer a secret sacrifice in the temple of Apollo whenever the Thyades awaken the Linites. And that the Greeks consider Dionysus lord and author not only of wine but of all moist nature, it is enough that Pindar bears witness, saying, "May Dionysus, rich in joy, increase the grove of trees, the holy radiance of harvest time." For this reason, those who revere Osiris are forbidden to destroy a cultivated tree or to stop up a spring of water. Not only do they call the Nile an effluence of Osiris, but simply all moisture. And in processions of the sacred rites, the water vessel is always carried in front, in honor of the god. And they represent the king by a reed and the southern quarter of the world as well, and the word reed, when translated, means watering and the conception of all things, and it is thought to resemble in its nature the generative organ. And when they celebrate the festival of the Pamelia, which is, as has been said, a phallic festival, they set out and carry around an image whose member is three times its natural size, for the god is a first principle, and every first principle multiplies from itself by its generative power what proceeds from it. And we are accustomed to say, often also as thrice, as in thrice blessed, and bonds three times as many, without limit. Unless, by Zeus, the ancients strictly meant the number three itself, for the moist nature, being the origin and generation of all things, made from the beginning the first three bodies, earth, air, and fire. And indeed the explanation added to the myth, that Typhon threw the genital member of Osiris into the river and Isis, did not find it, but fashioned and set up a likeness of it in its place, and ordained that it be honored and carried in procession, comes round to teaching this very point, that the generative and seminal power of the god had moisture as its first material, and through moisture was blended into things so as to enable them to share in generation. There is another account among the Egyptians, that Apophis, being a brother of Helios, made war on Zeus, and that Zeus, having taken Osiris as his ally, and together with him, having overthrown the enemy, adopted him as his son and named him Dionysus. And the mythical character of this account, too, can be shown to touch upon the truth concerning nature. For the Egyptians call Zeus Pneuma, breath spirit, to which the parched and fiery element is hostile. This element is not the sun, but has a certain kinship with the sun, while moisture, by quenching the excess of dryness, increases and strengthens the exhalations by which the breath is nourished and flourishes. Further, the Greeks consecrate ivy to Dionysus, and among the Egyptians it is said to be called Cheneseris, the name signifying, so they say, plant of Osiris. Ariston, then, who wrote the history of the colonies of the Athenians, came across a certain letter of Alexarchus, in which it is recorded that Dionysus, being the son of Zeus and Isis, is called by the Egyptians not Osiris but Arsaphs, with the letter alpha, signifying the manliness of the name. This is also indicated by Hermias in the first book of his work on the Egyptians, for he says that, when translated, Osiris means vigorous or strong. I pass over Amnesias, who identifies Dionysus, Osiris, and Serapis with Epaphus. And I pass over Anticlades, who says that Isis, being the daughter of Prometheus, cohabits with Dionysus. For the affinities already mentioned, concerning the festivals and the sacrifices, carry a more evident conviction than any witnesses. Among the stars, they consider Sirius to belong to Isis, since it draws up water, and they honor the lion and adorn the doorways of their temples with lion-mouth gargoyles, because the Nile floods, when first the sun comes together with the lion. And just as they hold the Nile to be an effluence of Osiris, so they hold that the earth is the body of Isis, not all of it, but that part which the Nile covers, fertilizing it and mingling with it. And from this union they say Horus is born. Now Horus is the season and blending of the surrounding air that preserves and nourishes all things, which they say was reared by Leto in the marshes around Buto, for the watery and drenched earth chiefly nurtures the exhalations that quench and relax dryness and drought. They call Nephthys the extremities and borderlands of the earth, touching upon the sea. Hence they also name Nephthys the end, and say that she cohabits with Typhon. And whenever the Nile, overflowing and increasing beyond measure, draws near to the outermost regions, they call this the union of Osiris with Nephthys, which is betrayed by the plants that spring up there, among which is the melilot. And the myth says that when this dropped and was left behind, Typhon became aware of the wrong done concerning the marriage. Hence Isis bore Horus legitimately, but Nephthys bore Anubis in secret. Yet in the king lists they record that Nephthys, when given in marriage to Typhon, was at first barren. And if this is said not of a woman but of the goddess, they are hinting at the utter unproductiveness and barrenness of the earth through sterility. The plot and tyranny of Typhon was the power of drought, which prevailed and dispersed the very moisture that generates and increases the Nile. And his accomplice, the queen of the Ethiopians, hints at the south winds from Ethiopia. For whenever these prevail over the Etesian winds, driving the clouds toward Ethiopia and preventing the rains that swell the Nile from bursting forth, Typhon, holding sway, scorches everything. And then, having wholly overpowered the Nile and driven it, shrunk by weakness and flowing hollow and low, back into himself, he thrusts it into the sea. For the so-called imprisonment of Osiris in the coffin seems to hint at nothing other than the hiding and disappearance of water. Hence they say that Osiris disappears in the month Athar, when, with the Etesian winds having wholly ceased, the Nile recedes and the land is laid bare. And as the night lengthens, the darkness increases, and the power of light is weakened and overcome, the priests perform other rites of mourning, and they cover a gilded cow with a black linen garment and display her in mourning for the goddess, for they consider the cow an image of Isis, and of the earth for 4 days, from the 17th, in succession, up to the 12th. For indeed the things mourned are four. First, the Nile receding and failing. Second, the north winds being wholly quenched as the south winds prevail. Third, the day becoming shorter than the night. And on top of all these, the stripping bare of the earth together with the bareness of the plants, which at that time shed their leaves. On the 19th day of the night they go down to the sea, and the sacred chest the stallists and the priests carry out, containing within it a golden box, into which they pour fresh water they have taken, and a shout goes up from those present as though Osiris were found. Then they knead fertile earth with the water, and mixing in spices and costly incense, they mold a small crescent-shaped image, and this they dress and adorn, signifying that they consider these gods to be the substance of earth and water. And as Isis in turn recovers Osiris and increases Horus, strengthened by exhalations and mists and clouds, Typhon was overpowered, but not destroyed. For the goddess who is mistress of the earth did not allow the nature opposed to moisture to be wholly destroyed, but relaxed and let it go, wishing the blending to remain, for it would not be possible for the world to be complete if the fiery element were to fail and disappear entirely. And if these things are not said contrary to what is likely, one might reasonably not reject that other account either, that Typhon once held sway over the portion belonging to Osiris, for Egypt was a sea. Hence to this day many shells are found in the mines and on the mountains, and all the springs and wells, of which there are many, contain salty and bitter water, as though it were a remnant of the ancient sea that had settled and grown stale there. But in time Horus prevailed over Typhon, that is to say, when there came a timely abundance of rains, the Nile drove back the sea, revealed the plain, and filled it up again with its deposits. And this account has the evidence of perception to confirm it. For we still see even now the river bringing fresh silt and advancing the land, as the deep sea gradually withdraws, and the sea, as the depths rise up because of the deposits, is flowing away. And Pharos, which Homer knew to be a day's sail distant from Egypt, is now a part of it, not because it moved forward or came up closer, but because the intervening sea was pushed back by the river, which builds up and nourishes the mainland. But these explanations are similar to those given in the theology of the Stoics. For they too say that the generative and nourishing breath is Dionysus, the striking and dividing force Heracles, the receptive principle Ammon, that which pervades the earth and its fruits Demeter and Kore, and that which pervades the sea Poseidon. And others, mixing in with these physical explanations some elements from astrological mathematics, hold that Typhon is called the solar system, and Osiris the lunar. For the moon, having a generative and moisture-producing light, is kindly and conducive to the offspring of animals and the growth of plants. Whereas the sun, with its unmixed and harsh fire, scorches and dries up the things that are growing and flourishing, and renders the greater part of the earth entirely uninhabitable through its blaze, and in many places even overpowers the moon. Hence the Egyptians always call Typhon Seth, which means overpowering or forcibly constraining. And they tell in myth that Heracles is established in the sun and revolves with it, and Hermes with the moon. For the works of the moon resemble those of reason and of surpassing wisdom, whereas those of the sun resemble blows carried out by force and strength. The Stoics say that the sun is kindled and nourished from the sea, while to the moon, the springs and lake waters send up a sweet and gentle exhalation. The Egyptians tell in myth that the death of Osiris occurred on the 17th, on which day the full moon is most plainly seen to be complete. Hence the Pythagoreans call this day obstruction, and in general hold this number in aversion. For of 16, a square number, and 18, an oblong number, which alone among plane numbers happen to have their perimeters equal to the areas they enclose, 17 falls between them, obstructs them, and separates them from one another, cutting the ratio of 9 to 8 into unequal intervals. As for the number of years, some say that Osiris lived, others that he reigned, 28 years, for that is the number of the moon's lights, and in that many days it completes its own cycle. The wood which they cut in the rites called the burial of Osiris they fashion into a crescent-shaped coffin, because the moon, when it draws near the sun, becomes crescent-shaped and disappears from view. And by the tearing of Osiris's body into 14 pieces, they hint at the number of days from full moon to new moon, during which the star wanes. The day on which the moon first appears, escaping the sun's rays and passing beyond the sun, they call imperfect good. For Osiris is a benefactor, and his name expresses much, not least an effective and beneficent power, as they say. The other name of the god, Omphis, the priest of Hermes says signifies benefactor, when translated. They also think that the risings of the Nile bear some relation to the lights of the moon. For the greatest rise, near Elephantine, comes to 28 cubits, matching the number of lights and measures of each monthly cycle. The smallest, near Mendes and Zoys, is 6 cubits, corresponding to the half-moon, and the middle rise near Memphis when it is regular is 14 cubits, corresponding to the full moon. The Apis, they say, is a living image of Osiris, and comes into being when a fertilizing light from the moon strikes and touches a cow in heat. Hence many features of Apis resemble the moon's phases, its bright parts being darkened by shaded ones. Moreover, on the new moon of the month Phaimnoth, they hold a festival which they call the entry of Osiris into the moon, this being the beginning of spring. Thus, placing the power of Osiris in the moon, they say that Isis, being his generative source, unites with him. That is why they also call the moon the mother of the universe, and think it has a nature that is both male and female, being filled and made pregnant by the sun, while it in turn casts forth into the air generative principles and sows them. For destruction, the power of Typhon does not always prevail, but is often mastered by generation, and being bound is again dissolved, and continues its struggle against Horus. Now Horus is this world around the earth, which is delivered neither wholly from destruction nor wholly from generation. Some make the myth a riddle about eclipses as well. For the moon is eclipsed when it is full, the sun standing opposite to it, and it falls into the shadow of the earth, just as they say Osiris falls into the coffin. And the moon in turn hides and makes the sun disappear at the times of conjunction, yet does not utterly destroy it, just as Isis does not destroy Typhon. When Nephthys bore Anubis, Isis substituted the child as her own. For Nephthys is that which is under the earth and unseen, while Isis is that which is above the earth and visible. And the circle that touches both of these and is called the horizon, being common to both, is named Anubis, and is likened in form to a dog, for the dog uses its sight equally by night and by day. And among the Egyptians, Anubis seems to have this same power that Hecate has among the Greeks, being both of the underworld and of Olympus. To some, Anubis seems to be Cronus. Hence, since he begets all things from himself and dog is contained within himself, he acquired the epithet of the dog.